This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, in for Neil Conan. Barely 3 weeks after Hurricane Frances left much of the Florida coast in tatters, Hurricane Jean has now exacerbated the damage. The 120-mile-per-hour winds ravaged what's known as Florida's Treasure Coast, an area studded with lagoons and retirement communities. But nowhere was Jean's damage more traumatic than in the Caribbean island of Haiti. The storm hit the island last week, killing at least 1,500, and the death toll continues to rise. Relief efforts in the port city of Gonaive have been stymied by rampant looting, widespread hunger, and the growing threat of infectious disease. The size of the disaster is in large part due to massive deforestation. Without trees to hold back the water on slopes, muddy runoff turned into torrential floods. Jean also swept through neighboring Dominican Republic with even stronger winds, but killed only 24 people there. The Dominican Republic is similarly poor, but was far better equipped to mitigate the hurricane's wreckage. This hour, we'll talk about why Haiti was hit so hard and about how developing countries with limited resources deal with and prepare for major storms. We'll be taking your calls. What questions do you have about the conditions which led to the enormous destruction in Haiti? Or if you've been part of relief efforts for storms in underdeveloped countries, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. To give us a better understanding of how environmental issues contributed to the damage in Haiti, we're joined by Pierre Chauvet, co-founder of the Haitian Foundation for the Environment and a spokesperson for the Federation of Friends of Nature in Haiti. He joins us by phone from Port-au-Prince. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and good afternoon to all the NPR's listeners.
Well, thank you. And as I just mentioned, and deforestation is a major problem in Haiti. Can you give us a better idea of just how widespread deforestation is in Haiti?
Well, there is no specific and clear data on deforestation, but what I can say is that in the 1920s, there was about 40% of the land was still forested. In the 1950s, about 20%. And since 1986, when FAN was founded, the percentage was varied between 2 and 3%, and we expect nowadays to be around 1% of the land which is still having forest.
So, I mean, am I right in saying that the practical consequences of that is that there's nothing to hold the water back from just sort of tearing the hillsides down and pouring muddy water into the cities?
Correct, because Haiti, the name Haiti is an Indian name that means land of high mountains. 80% of our territory is mountain. So when the topsoil in the mountain doesn't have the greenery, doesn't have forest to act like a sponge in order to retain the rainwater and regulate it, then whenever it rains, the water goes immediately through the stiff slope into the valleys, into the ravines, into the rivers, and then if it rains a lot, then the strength of that water flow is higher, and it does produce destructions.
So did people just not have time to get to higher ground, or did they not realize that getting to higher ground was a priority?
Well, in Gonaive in particular, people are used to have some kind of flooding. It's a very flat city surrounded by mountains. So whenever it rains, normally people are used to have 1 or 2 feet of water in the streets. And so street kids usually play in the water. But after 1 or 2 hours, the city's life goes back to normal. So people were expecting the same thing to happen because it did not rain a lot in Gonaive. There was very little rain during the day. The heavy rains occurred in the mountains. And by 3 to 4 p.m. last Saturday, then the water level started to rise. And the destruction varied from one area or another, depending if you were close to a river, which is a normal canal for water, or if you were in the plains, because the rivers just went overboard. So slowly the water level rose, because since it was already raining for about 1 week, the topsoil was already wet, so there was not enough infiltration. So the water level went up to close to 3 meters.
I see. And is that where most of the deaths occurred, in Gonaïves or elsewhere?
Gonaïves being a city which is now close to 300,000 inhabitants, of course you had a concentration of populations that resulted into more human suffering there. But this problem arose in the countryside, in the whole northwest tip of Haiti, where the heavy rain did occur. Because Jane was already passing by Haiti, was already on the way to the Bahamas. So it was just one of the feeding part of that hurricane, which was not a hurricane at that time. It was just a tropical storm. But it's slowly moving, and then the rain in the mountain for about a few hours was sufficient due to that vulnerability of the area did produce that overflow of water.
So does the government in Haiti have any kind of policy to deal with this issue of deforestation?
Well, there are programs in Haiti, but they're not sufficient. PAN, which has been created since 1986, and we have been mostly doing public awareness programs and actions in order to actually bring people to a certain level of knowledge, and so that they can understand, and mostly decision makers, of the gravity of the situation. We have not been successful enough to, for instance, to have for the past 17 years decision makers accept the what we call a state of emergency that was declared in 1987, that's about 17 years ago, during a colloquium that was happening at the School of Agriculture. After 3 days of presentation by experts, everybody could see the crisis coming. Everybody could see that down the line there would be some disaster coming if the deforestation was not stopped immediately and massive reforestation occurring. So there was a petition signed by a lot of people, all those present, as an outcry to the community, say, listen, we have a problem in the country. We must declare a state of emergency in order to stop this process and start rebuilding. Unfortunately, nothing happened for this past 17 years. And we are trying right now, once again, with this occurrence in Gonaïves in September, but also there was also a certain disaster last May, where the city of Fonverrette was, for the second time, totally destroyed by another ravine, and also the villages of Mapou in the south part of Haiti were totally covered with water, and up to now there's water there. And all these situations are, again, proof that this call for state of emergency are true or real, and that action must be taken.
The United Nations program, the International Strategy for Disaster Reduction, works with countries to develop strategies to prevent catastrophes like what we've seen in Haiti. Mr. Salvano Briseño heads that program. He joins us by phone from Amsterdam. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
So, from your perspective, to what extent was the scope of the disaster in Haiti preventable?
Well, it is, of course, difficult to say how exactly, but clearly there are a number of vulnerabilities that if they would have been worked constantly, regularly, for a long time, as it was mentioned before, for more than 17 years, 18 years, there's been recommendations being given on how to improve environmental management, how to improve governance, how to improve community development and participation. If all of those would have been dealt with, then it could have been prevented. In other words, disaster prevention requires work in several areas, not just in one.
We're talking with Paul Briceño from the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction Program and Pierre Chauvet, founder of the Haitian Foundation for the Environment, about the devastation that's occurred in Haiti due to tropical storm, as it was then, Gene. And we'd like to take your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Dan in Salt Lake City, Utah. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. And your question?
Well, I just had a comment. I lived in Honduras during Hurricane Mitch in 1998, which was a pretty devastating hurricane. And one of the questions that I heard you discussing on the show was, why was it that people didn't move to higher ground? Was it because they didn't know, or what were some of the reasons? And one of the reasons that the destruction was so great as far as human life during Hurricane Mitch was directly related to the poverty. The crime rates are so high across the country that everyone has television and radio. They all knew that the floods were coming, that the waters were going to rise, and many people refused to leave because they were afraid that their homes were going to be broken into and that their things would be stolen, and they stayed there until it was too late. And so in addition to the home being swept away, thousands of people were also swept into the waters that were caused by the hurricane, and it greatly increased the toll on human life, much more than it really needed to be.
Well, Mr. Briceño, how do you deal with that kind of a problem? It's not strictly an environmental problem.
Well, clearly that's one of the issues that needs to be looked at, and security and safety is very important. Now, when you have a system where communities are organized to deal and are prepared and have been developing systems by which they take care of their own development, and they manage these things, and there are a number of cases in India and Bangladesh and many in Vietnam, in many countries, and even in the Caribbean, Jamaica, Cuba, there are several countries where communities are better organized to take care of these issues as well, the security and the safety. Now, of course, you need good governance for that. You need political stability, which is unfortunately lacking in Haiti.
Right. And Pierre Chauvet, how about you? How do you respond to this problem, which is clearly not just an environmental one?
Well, it is true that people did stay in their home. Many people, as a matter of fact, died in their home because even when they wanted to open the doors, they could not because the water level was already 1 or 1.5 meter high, and then the water pressure prevented them to open the doors, or the mud that had already stabilized on the lower ground. So it is true that they are still finding bodies inside their homes, and it might be also the fact that people either did not believe what was happening or were not aware of what was happening, and it's part of bad management all over. I mean, I think somebody used the word good governance. That's the key word nowadays.
Pierre Chauvet, I just wonder, finally, if I could ask you, how long is it going to take to dig out from this, and are there any lessons, do you think, the government will have learned?
How long? I think they asked the Minister of Public Works this question yesterday on the radio. He says he expects 3 months. I've heard some other sources in about 6 months. And I don't know. There is no traditions to deal with such a catastrophe in Haiti. We have been spared for the past 25 years by strong hurricanes, thanks God. But this time we did not even have a hurricane. We had just a tropical storm and some water that really overflowed the river banks. We could have gotten Hurricane Ivan straight on us. We didn't get it. Imagine what would have happened. Lesson to be learned. Well, I do hope, and we all do hope, at the ecological associations, which are mostly involved nowadays in Haiti, that this government will declare that state of emergency, which is the first step that proof that people are aware of the problems and they are ready to deal with it by having the proper prevention programs, by having the immediate response programs, because right now it's a logistical nightmare to bring supplies and relief to the population of Gonaïve.
Okay, Pierre Chauvet, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Thank you very much for joining us. He's co-founder Pierre Chauvet of the Haitian Foundation for the Environment. We'll continue this discussion after the break. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palka in Washington. We're talking about hurricanes and underdeveloped countries. Our guest is Salvano Briseño, who heads the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction Program. He joins us by phone from Amsterdam. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Mr. Briseño, what kind of programs need to be in place to prevent the kind of destruction we saw in Haiti? And is the Haitian government capable of putting those programs into place?
Well, certainly not. And it would be terribly unfair to expect such a poor government and poor society to deal with it alone. When one looks at what the international community does in these cases, and in particular the donor countries that support Haiti, there is where I would put the blame on, because there is much more resources and much more interest in providing relief than there is to support programs of prevention. If some of the resources that are going into the relief operations or that are put aside for relief operations would be invested in prevention, there would not be a need to do that. Now, of course, the issue is that the donors have to get their act together and agree, and that's a very difficult task for them to do. If the key donors to Haiti would just simply agree on investing in development, community development, good governance, prevention programs, it would save a lot of lives.
I see. We mentioned earlier that the Dominican Republic was hit by Hurricane Jeanne, or Tropical Storm Jeanne, I guess, as it was then, another poor country in the Caribbean, but the damage there was far less severe than Haiti's. Can you explain the difference in the impact?
Certainly. First of all, Dominican Republic has a more stable political regime that has allowed for developing some systems, even if in a poor manner, but they have, however, some early warning systems that are in place and that work. In Haiti, unfortunately, they do not work as well. And that those early warning systems allowed for people to be better prepared. The management of their forest, the environmental management, is also stronger. Dominican Republic, even though they do have some level of deforestation, is never the same compared to Haiti. So there are a number of areas in urban growth. For example, the city of Gonaïves has been allowed to grow in a terribly unplanned manner, and that's been one of the main causes also. People are just in the middle of the floodplains. So there are a number of issues that work better in Dominican Republic, despite being also a poor country.
Now, you've said that Cuba, which was recently hit by Hurricane Ivan, is one example of a poor nation that has a successful model for dealing with hurricanes. Tell us what you mean by that. What did Cuba get right in terms of disaster reduction?
Cuba has a system that has allowed them to organize their communities better and have them better prepared to deal with these disasters. In Cuba, it's, of course, the other extreme of political stability, and regardless of one's opinion on their regime for other purposes, it is certainly an authoritarian regime, and they have a lot of other problems. But for the purpose of organizing their people to respond and to prevent these disasters, they're very good at that. Everyone has a task already assigned that knows very well what to do. There are some people in the community that take care of the old people. Some others take care of the animals, the cattle. They protect everything. They even wrap up the banana trees not to lose the production entirely with the hurricanes. They wrap them with special plastic bags and cords. So there's a very well-organized system.
NPR's Tom Gelton recently returned from Cuba, and he joins us by phone from Miami, Florida. Hi, Tom. You were in Cuba on the heels of Ivan. What were the conditions for the homes and infrastructure when you were there?
Well, the area that I was in, the great good fortune in Cuba with respect to Hurricane Ivan is that the hurricane at the last minute veered off to the west and basically just brushed the extreme western tip of Cuba, and that portion of Cuba is largely, it's not uninhabited, but it's far more sparsely settled than the part of Cuba, for example, around Havana, where it was feared that Ivan was going to hit in the first place. So there was not a lot of damage, not as much damage to houses as could have been the case if the hurricane had hit further to the east. In the municipality where I was looking at things, which was Sandino, one of the hardest hit, I think 400 houses were destroyed, or 400 houses were damaged, only about 100 were destroyed. So that was really sort of a minimal impact. And no one was injured, no one was killed in this past hurricane. So it really, Cuba did come out, considering the size and the strength of that hurricane, Cuba really did come out in pretty good shape.
So how did they accomplish this? I mean, what did they do right?
Well, as your expert from the United Nations was just pointing out, the evacuation in Cuba is something that's taken extremely seriously. All the resources of the government are focused on preparing for a hurricane. All the communication, the news media, you know, the radio and television is all focused on this virtually nonstop. So people are extremely well informed about what the hurricane means and what they have to do. And again, as your expert said, the society is so highly organized. Everyone has a task to do, and the state authorities are extremely efficient and thorough at carrying out an evacuation. They, in the villages where I visited, they came in 72 hours ahead of the expected impact of the hurricane and ordered everybody to move out. And one of the novel or innovative things they did that I haven't seen done elsewhere is not only did they move the people out, but they brought in trucks. And they moved out their possessions as well, their TV sets, their refrigerators, even their mattresses. And one of the reasons that people are, of course, sometimes reluctant to leave their homes is because they don't want to, they're worried about losing their, you know, their possessions in a place like Cuba, which is very poor. These are very important to people. So with the state moving these, not only the people out, but moving out their possessions, they felt a lot more confident. And they were, as I say, they came in 72 hours ahead of time. Then 48 hours ahead of time, a day later, they came back again, looked around for stragglers, anyone who had sort of escaped the first sweep. And then they came back again a third time, a day before the hurricane hit. So by the time the hurricane hit, there was not a soul left. Now, this was done with great efficiency, in part because Cuba is a, you know, what you could call a police state in the sense that you know, the state has absolute authority over its citizens and is able to do this. I'm here in Miami right now, and we saw here in Florida a very low rate of evacuation in advance of Hurricane Jeanne, in part because in the end it is up to people to decide for themselves whether they want to evacuate or not. And in Cuba, that's not the case.
Well, I was just going to ask that. I mean, is that kind of adherence to evacuation orders something you can only accomplish in a state like Cuba, where saying no has dire consequences, whereas in the land of the free in America, saying no is, you know, personal liberty, and you can expect the government to help you out afterwards?
Well, I think there are trade-offs, you know, to be considered. And, you know, to the extent a society values freedom and openness and privacy, it's obviously going to be far, far harder to pull off something like Cuba did. That, you know, I think that ultimately that probably is only possible in an authoritarian setting. Nevertheless, there are elements of what Cuba did that I think are probably replicable. You know, the making the resources of the state available to people to evacuate their possessions is one that could be done. Another thing that Cuba does that I think is important is that this is done in the context of a public health campaign. They don't just take care of people before the hurricane. They also come in afterwards when there's been, and this would be particularly important in a place like Haiti where there's been so much flooding, they come in afterwards and are very cognizant of the dangers that flooding and standing water presents. There's incredible fumigation programs in Cuba. I mean, they actually try and stay out of their way because mm-hmm. they fumigate to a great extent. They go inside, they fumigate all the public buildings, they fumigate the schools, they fumigate people's houses. I mean, they do a tremendous amount of fumigation because they're very worried about mosquito-borne diseases in the aftermath of a hurricane. So I think there are elements that can be replicated, but there's no question that there are trade-offs. I think another of the trade-offs that you see in Cuba is between the tendency to look to the state to protect you versus taking an initiative yourself. I mean, in a society like the United States where we like to promote free enterprise and we would like to promote people taking responsibility for themselves, maybe there's an element there in the Cuban approach of paternalism and state protection that we would find objectionable. I certainly found a lot of Cubans, and this is something that you see not only with respect to hurricane preparations, but with respect to many aspects of society. I see a lot of Cubans who have just, over the years, sort of learned to depend on the state to take care of them. And I think that probably has somewhat of a diminishing effect on people taking responsibility for themselves. So that's another trade-off to consider.
Okay. Hey, Tom, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us this afternoon.
It's great. Anytime.
Okay. That's NPR's Tom Gelton, who recently returned from Cuba. He joined us by phone from Miami, Florida. The political climate of developing nations plays a large role in how these countries deal with natural disasters. Dan Erickson is director of Caribbean Programs for the Inter-American Dialogue, a group that looks at a variety of issues affecting North and communication on issues affecting North and South America. He joins us in Studio 3A here in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, as we discussed earlier, most countries in the Caribbean region have dealt with severe weather far better than Haiti. Have we heard all the reasons Haiti is worse off than other Caribbean nations, or is there something we've not touched on yet?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of different reasons that your callers have pointed out, and clearly in the Caribbean basin as a whole, there's also a wide range of different political systems, from obviously authoritarian Cuba to the smaller English-speaking democracies to Haiti, which is bordering on a failed state. That said, I think that Haiti, in addition to sort of lack of preparedness in terms of getting out advanced warning to a hurricane and also slow follow-up, simply the structures of the country in terms of the buildings, city planning, as one of your callers pointed out, aren't up to par with many of the other countries. And so for all those reasons, it's much more vulnerable to these types of flooding.
There's poverty here. Is it also political instability that's exacerbating these problems? They must make things worse and harder to set up standards that you know will be adhered to.
Well, sure. I mean, there's no enforcement. And mm-hmm. so in the absence of enforcement, although some of Haiti's laws on a variety of issues are actually quite good, they're simply not enforced. And that goes to building codes. You also don't have a level of public security in Haiti that you have with other countries. You don't really have a police force that works. You do have a United Nations force there now, but they're only at half the level that they're supposed to be at in terms of manpower. And frankly, they're there to ensure security and help disarm the rebels. They're not there as part of a humanitarian relief task force. And so now you have Brazilian generals, Argentinian soldiers from Asia who are engaged in humanitarian operations when they're really there to keep the peace.
We're talking this hour about the ability of underdeveloped countries to cope with natural disasters. The example, unfortunately, is the recent hurricane, or as it was then, Tropical Storm Jeanne, that caused massive flooding and loss of life in Haiti. My guests are Salvano Briseño of the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction Program and Dan Erickson of the Caribbean Programs for the Inter-American Dialogue. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call from one of our listeners, Liz in Martha's Vineyard. Welcome to the program.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on the program. I've visited Haiti on 7 different years, and one of the things, being a farmhand, that I've been very aware of is the deforestation. But I think one of the most important things that needs to be mentioned here is the linkage between politics and economics and what we now see as a devastating result of the deforestation. And this has been going on for many, many years, since Haitian independence, which is 200 years ago. And I have, you know, my feeling is that the exploitation of the Haitian Garden of Eden for sugar production, you know, and this is under the French, and what we see now, of course, is continued deforestation. What's not ever mentioned are things like, what did the U.S. embargo most recently do in the 90s, when there had been an effort for trying to get people to really use propane for cooking? And propane, of course, and gasoline were prohibited in the embargo, and Haitians turned back to what had been the traditional fuel, which is charcoal. And the part of the problem with the clear cutting is, how are they going to cook their food?
Okay.
And I think this is very political, and I'd like Mr. Erickson to maybe address that in a little more depth.
Okay. Mr. Erickson, what about that? Quickly, because we only have a few more minutes left in this segment.
Sure. Well, in terms of the embargo, there's an embargo when Haiti was ruled by a military regime from 91 to 94, and more recently a suspension of direct aid to the Haitian government from 2000 to 2004. Until President Aristide was ousted. And I think that what you have in Haiti is basically a mutually reinforcing cycle of poverty. Trees have been the answer for Haitians, both in terms of energy, heat to cook, and also in the absence of jobs, cutting down trees supplies a source of income. And so that's why deforestation has been driven to such extreme levels there.
Mr. Briseño, what about that?
What I would insist is on the lack of ability from the donor countries to agree on a common strategy to help Haiti and to invest on development. There is still too much of bilateral aid that goes only into the interest of each individual donor. Or even worse, there is much more interest in just having money for relief rather than for prevention. I think those are two main obstacles that need to be addressed and have a very deep political root, as the lady was saying earlier, with whom I fully agree.
Did you have Mr. Erickson?
No, I mean, I think that I agree with his viewpoint. Really, what Haiti needs is a sustained long-term strategy. We haven't come up with one yet. It doesn't look like we're coming up with one very soon, and Haitians are paying the price.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, and I thank you both. First, let me thank Silvano Briseño. He heads the United Nations International Strategy for Disaster Reduction Program. He joined us by phone from Amsterdam. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dan Erickson is the Director of Caribbean Programs for the Inter-American Dialogue. He joined us here in Studio 3A in Washington. Thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back from a short break, we'll go to England, where events in Iraq, including uncertainty over the fate of British hostage Kenneth Bigley, are overshadowing the annual conference of Prime Minister Tony Blair's Labour Party. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.